This is the Leadership and Insurance Podcast, brought to you by FinPro Search Partners.
Insurance companies are businesses and they need to look for the long term and be sustainable.
We went from zero to one and now it's going from one to 100.
Insurance as a concept, as a kind of service, is brilliant. The execution is what we're looking at now.
I think the companies that are going to succeed are the ones that are going to understand and master the art of intent.
When we talk about innovation, we lean too heavily to think about technology and we don't think about creating a culture of innovation.
I think innovation is essentially continuous improvement of existing processes and platforms and product.
Right? It's got to be easy. It's got to be seamless.
Hello and welcome to the Leadership and Insurance Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Bond, and I'm very lucky today to be joined by Chris Slater, who's CEO and co-founder of Okka, which I believe I've got right. Did I get that right, Chris?
Good.
Chris, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast. I'm really excited to have this, letting people behind the scenes. We've obviously had a good conversation beforehand, and I think there's so much to cover off. So I'm going to try and be more efficient than I usually am with my questions. But before we kick things off, as is tradition on the podcast, Chris, it'd be great if you could introduce yourself and obviously the Okka business.
Great. Thanks for having me on, Alex. And Chris Slater, founder at Okka here, the carbon insurance company. Very simply, we are looking to ensure that every carbon credit is insured. We're solving a problem really around making sure that in the voluntary carbon market for buyers of credits, they get the confidence and protections that insurance can provide. And then for sellers of credits, they really get the opportunity to wrap the credits with insurance, defend many of the accusations that have been held on projects to date, and really help enhance their offering. So we're about 8 months into our journey, 9 months into our journey, and looking to bring our first product to market 1st of January.
Exciting, really exciting. And it's such an exciting place to talk about insurance because solving real world issues, and there's so much for us to get our teeth into. So I think it'd be amiss of me if we started this conversation without talking about your history. You're Simply Business, so one of the sort of OGs of insurtech, you can look at it that way. I think we could say that that journey, what from there to here? So now you've Simply Business, great journey there, and now why the carbon market? Why are you focusing on this?
Yeah, it's interesting you say about one of the original insurtechs. I mean, certainly if I think back to the early days, 2004, 2005, when we were founding Simply Business, the concept was a mere distance away. But indeed, technology, use of technology was such a fundamental part in the growth of that business. And I had a wonderful time, 13 years scaling a business that I'm very proud today still, I think, lives to some of the values that we wanted to build the business around, great customer experience, really delivering new products into the markets. When I jumped off that ship on the full-time basis in 2017, when we got acquired by Travelers, I stayed on as an advisor. I never actually thought I'd come back into insurance, if I'm honest. There was lots of opportunities presented to me at that time, but nothing really excited me about the space as much as what Simply Business had done. So sort of went off into the wilderness of investing, sort of venture investing, and actually tried to get a private equity fund off the ground, but invested actually in a number of businesses across impact, fintech, and a couple of insurtech businesses. And it was through those investments, actually, on the US side, with my exec chair James Hall, who's a serial entrepreneur over there, invested in a couple of his businesses. One of them was an embedded insurance play in the auto space called Salty. It's now turned out into another business called Embedded Insurance. But anyway, James and I were chatting at the tail end of 21-22, and it was sort of coincidence, actually. He had a carbon credit contract come across his desk. And he said to me, "Chris, what are you up to at the moment?" I said, "Not a huge amount. I just exited a mental health business." And he said, "Do you know anything about carbon credits?" I said, "I know absolutely nothing." And then really went, Alex, on a journey of discovery, diving in and understanding the voluntary carbon market and the compliance markets globally. And what fascinated me as I went through that research last year was the two things that most people I was speaking to were about was one was risk and one was quality. So on the risk side, how do we mitigate risks from a buyer's perspective when we're buying credits? We buy these credits, they're linked to projects. If something happens to the project, there's no recourse. Effectively, the purchase of these credits have those investments sat on the balance sheet with no availability of any elegant risk transfer mechanism. So this whole concept of risk existed in the market. And then the second aspect, as I said, was quality. So how do I, as a buyer of credit, understand the quality of the credit? And how do I ensure that one credit effectively equals one ton of CO2 that's being avoided or sequestered from the atmosphere? And with those two sort of broad themes and continuing dialogue, it just made sense that insurance was a missing part of the capital stack in the market. And for the market to scale, my belief then and my belief even more today is that insurance is a really important pillar to help the market scale, grow, and become a much more efficient and effective market. Ideally, in the end, bringing more liquidity into space, because what insurance does, it gives confidence, it gives people the ability to take risk. And it's a very nascent, still very nascent market and evolving market. And we need people to take more risk. And therefore, insurance, and Ocker, the carbon insurance company, is really there to help people do that.
Yeah, because the quality thing is an issue. I'm trying to think what it was. I think it was in a Wired article that I read it at length. And I sort of dug into it a little bit more. Is the quality of some of these carbon projects is some of the overriding criticism, isn't it? It's like exactly that, ensuring that you are getting what you're buying. Is that still sort of the biggest criticism that sits out there that people are concerned about, is the quality of these projects?
100%. In fact, if you look at 2023, has been a tough year for the voluntary carbon market. Mm. Articles in when the UK and the Guardian and Oxford reports, over the pond, Bloomberg, Wall Street Journal, actually a New Yorker article only last weekend, really making some pretty serious accusations around, as you say, the quality of the projects. And are the projects delivering on the promises of, as I say, either avoiding CO2 emissions or sequestering? But those challenges are those that have faced many new markets. And look, it's a complex arena, different project types, different regions and different locations, generating or sequestering carbon over a long time period. This isn't this isn't in months, this is in years. And therefore, really insurance, I believe, can play a role in trying to cut through some of that and take a very pragmatic approach to going, okay, we accept that there are unforeseen issues. So insurance plays a role in terms of managing that. But also there is error rate that exists in the market. There's this assessment and a methodology and scientific approaches to understanding whether the carbon has been sequestered or not. Now, that should tend to zero over time, but we're very much, as I say, that sort of adolescent, early stage of the science, and the science still developing. So I believe with our first insurance product, we're helping try and solve some of that error rate, trying to provide a recourse for the buyers of the credits that if the science does move on and or the project isn't maybe delivering, rather than throwing the baby out with the bathwater, insurance can play a role of making good that promise and making good that commitment. So to your point, yeah, there's lots of challenges, and the key one really is around that quality.
Yeah, insurance can be a good referee in this market, can't it? And I think, it's that was all the kind of negative press that I saw. But it's that frustrating thing of going, it has to be the right move, but it has to be done at quality. There's some echo for me there of the crypto market. Like, I'm a big believer in cryptocurrencies and the value of them, but bad actors, early first movers, bad technology in some of those as well. Like, and that doesn't say that we throw out that as a kind of proposition. But this is even more pressing. We need to get this right. So talk us through the specific product that you're launching. What part of the carbon credit value chain are you insuring? And probably why this product? Because I know you've got more than a few kind of in mind for the future.
Yeah, and I think the... just to pick up on the point you've mentioned there, Alex, around the fact that it is a new market. As new markets develop, especially in unregulated markets, this is an unregulated voluntary market. Companies, corporations are participating in them because either shareholders are driving them to do it, they think it's the right thing to do, they want to make commitments to net zero, all those reasons, but they're voluntarily doing it. Now, I think what we'll start to see is these markets, as this market develops, is more compliant structures come in to help that market look much more like a compliant market. And again, insurance can play a very important role in that. To your question on where do we sit in the evolution of a carbon credit, we really mapped out the journey of a credit from its inception. So if you think about the reforestation project and the funding required to basically reforest the land, tender and operationalize and look after that forest, there's lots of risks that sit at that end of the spectrum, delivery of those credits over a time period. But we've really come at it from the buyer's perspective. We've come at it from the fact that, or the point where a credit's been issued, the buyer of the credit is then taking the risk. They're purchasing the credit and they're making claims off the back of that credit around their net zero. And we see the risks, and we've spoken to many large US-based corporations around the risks they hold. And therefore, our first product, our Carbon Protect product, really sits at that post-issuance. So think of it very much like a warranty product or a bond product. It wraps the credit and travels with the credit as the credit gets bought and sold and then ultimately retired. And really, we're providing for those two key areas. One, the unforeseen risks, so that be that natural catastrophe or some human-induced events that effectively relinquish release carbon back into the atmosphere, or the invalidation, so that error rate that I talked about in the market. And that's our first product, sat at the post-issuance credit, ensuring and protecting buyers when they buy the credits.
Nice. I wanted to understand where embedded fits in. So, we talked about the embedded ink business as well. Is this being sold as an embedded product? And if so, how does that work in this marketplace?
Yeah, I'm a strong believer in the embedded insurance space. Going all the way back to that the start of our conversation around Simply Business, coming out of Simply Business and thinking about where the insurance market may go. Where I invested as an investor was in those embedded insurance players, because I truly think that over time that's the place where a more economic, more efficient insurance market plays its best role. And therefore, when thinking about the carbon market, we've very much taken a view of, well, where can we embed the product into the ecosystem, where again it just makes sense. It drives efficiency through the processing of the insurance purchase. It makes it easier for the buyers, and therefore, absolutely, Alex, what we're thinking about is we, as our first customers, are really the sellers of credits. So as they sell the credit, they embed the insurance with the credit. So when the buyer purchases the credit, it's already insured. And in doing so, really, it's a platform play to really help make it easy, make it seamless, and enhance the value of that credit once it's insured. Effectively, an insured credit being more valuable than an uninsured one.
And this is we had the team from Armed on the podcast, and they were talking about embedding their insurance products alongside their security products. And, you're buying the security product and it almost becomes a value-added product or product element. So you're buying the carbon credit and you get the insurance as part of it, and therefore you want to buy those credits because they're insured at the same time. And we talked about it with Armored. It's like, that for me is the perfect form of embedded. You know, there's been a lot of push in embedded, and I jokingly said at one point, I said to my team when we were trying to get guests on the podcast, and I just went, we can't have another embedded person on to sell the proposition of embedded, because I don't think the idea is questionable about that it's the right way to sell insurance, because insurance is a grudge purchase. You want to kind of it to just fit into your life. But it's about the application of that, is that there are some people that I would buy from, but this is the perfect instance. So essentially, you're buying something to ensure, in certain respects anyway, but the carbon credit is like you want to kind of reduce your net zero. This is something you're buying to go towards that. So to then have an insurable product element attached to it, embedded within that, just makes perfect sense, because I also think the distribution and success of a product like this would be quite difficult if you sold it as an additional, post-sale purchase.
100%. I don't know. Yeah. A couple of bits there, Alex. I think conceptually embedded is very easy to describe, but I think actually making it work comes down to some of the technical complexities of delivering an insurance product, the regulatory landscape, the declarations that need to be made, the sharing of data, the use of that data to price accurately the risk. And that's where only the better players in the space are really getting it right, where it is seamless, where it's at the point of sale, you're doing data exchanges under the hood, you're really utilizing the technology to deliver the product in the most efficient manner. And that's exactly our view. We sort of take a point of, you've got to put it wrapped around the credit. And to your point, it just makes sense because from the buyer's perspective, especially in a new market, what they don't want to be doing is going buying the credits and then going off to Bob or Jane's insurance broker to say, right, I've now got all these credits. Can you insure them for me? It's just it introduces inefficiency, introduces cost. And we all know in the insurance space, the margins from the insurance premium going into that sort of distribution are just unsustainable, I think, long term. So exactly, we think getting into the ecosystem, wrap the credit, and the sellers of the credits love the concept. For them, to your point, they can now signal to the market, okay, our credits are insured. And therefore, over time, I believe that all credits, that's our mission, all credits will be insured, at least those that are of a suitable quality.
That in itself will start, you could get to a point where that tells the story. If it doesn't have an insurable element, you think, well, is it worth the paper it's written on? It's a complete side note, but is there something like there's no sort of rating agency for credit projects or is there is there a Moody's for carbon credits?
There is, there's a number globally that have sprung up over the last 4 or 5 years. In fact, we formed commercial partnerships with two of the most prominent ones, B0 and Silvera. And they do a lot of on the ground work to effectively assess the projects to then rate them. And again, they've introduced those models with the same sort of thesis that buyers are taking risk. How do they reduce that risk? They work with a rating agency to assess and diligence the project. And if the project's then rated at a certain grade, they take that confidence that, okay, that's a project that we are willing to invest in credits, we're willing to buy. Mm-hmm. We then go a step further in that we're actually insuring the credit and actually putting capital to work to say, if that credit doesn't deliver on its promise, then ultimately we will make you whole. So I think they complement each other quite nicely. And again, I use the bond market as an analogy quite often, because I think that's really a financial instrument rated, and an insured bond is usually more valuable.
Mm. Yeah, and it's a three-way, it's essentially almost a three-way agreement as well, isn't it? So it's very much, it's almost like the surety market product. I wanted to talk about the formation of the company because what's the structure at the moment? Are you operating as an MGA? Are you going for full stack? What's the evolution of the business there?
Yeah, great question. So we decided pretty early doors that we were going to become a full stack insurance carrier. A couple of key reasons, really, and having lived the journey on, actually, I guess in my early days, I worked at an insurer and then went into building a broker at Simply Business. But then our MGA and actually the building of products within Simply Business was such a critical part of the evolution of that business that as we formed Ocker, really it was about, okay, well, what is going to define success in this market? New market, new products required. You need to hold the pen. You need to be able to create product because I think this market is going to evolve. It's going to change. The products are going to need to move and iterate at pace. And therefore, we took a very early decision that we were going to become a full stack carrier and actually put our own capital at risk to basically write the products. So we've been on the journey of building our pricing and underwriting over the last 9 to 12 months. And actually, as of last week, got approval from Lloyd's in principle to write our first policy as a syndicate, the Ocker 1922 syndicate, come 1st of January. So we're bringing that that dream to life come the 1st of January. With a huge amount of work that we've done over the last 9 months. So if you think about it from conception of the business, building a product, testing it, getting customer commitments, and now with a syndicate live 1st of January, we've made huge progress to hopefully enter the market and start to scale.
Amazing. Amazing. Presumably, are you utilizing the sort of syndicate in a box setup? Is that? Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, really. Yeah, I mean, which is perfect. I mean, it's exactly the sort of thing that we want to see in Lloyd's. It's the sort of innovation that we want to see. And this is the sort of thing that, we want to see this syndicate in a box used for. I mean, there's a load of reasons why I could kind of say, but did you consider alternatives to Lloyd's? Or was Lloyd's kind of the only realistic kind of access point to producing this sort of product?
We considered quite a few options, actually. You know, as a US-based business, I'm always at odds to stress that. Well, obviously, with a UK accent, it can get confusing. But, a US-based business, we're delivering product through a US service company that's licensed across all 50 states now. Because we're serving US corporations, they're the ones that are investing significant capital, buying credits, and ultimately being subject to impending regulatory climate disclosure requirements. So that's really where the thesis has come from. And then, therefore, when we looked at where do we write the policy, looked at offshore captives, looked at actually purchasing excess and surplus lines insurance business. But Lloyd's really just made sense. And it made sense for a couple of reasons. First of all, it's branding, delivering our products to US Fortune 100 businesses, having that Lloyd's brand was important. Secondly, and also A-rated paper, obviously there. Secondly, was the license. Whilst we're a US-based business, we do believe, and already getting demand for our product across the globe. So our ability to sell our product globally over time is important. And then third, and maybe more technically, it's the capital capabilities that Lloyd's gives you, not only in terms of being able to stand up a syndicate in a box and put the necessary capital, but it's the access to that syndicate model that can tier and provide a much broader, a much more scale capacity capability, which we believe this business is going to scale quickly, is what we're going to need. And as a new venture, you need that ability to get sizable capital on the balance sheet to be able to write business.
Yeah. All makes perfect sense. Wanted to talk about, I thought this was really interesting when we had this conversation before, because when you're launching a new product, new market, there's a sort of thinking that better to have the only product in town and therefore people have to buy a product. But we sort of kicked that around, really. So why is competition such a good thing for kind of new markets? Why don't you want to be the only show in town if you've got a carbon insurance product?
Yeah, it's maybe I'm unique in this. I'm probably not, but I've always been a big advocate for competition. I think you need competition for a market to prosper. I think back to my Simply Business days. We took some fairly strange routes of actually inviting competition into our weekly all hands to see what we were doing, to get inspired by some of our ways of distributing product, of delivering better customer experience. Ideas are cheap. It's about how do you execute on those ideas and how do you bring those ideas to life? And in a new market, which the voluntary carbon market is, we need as many players as possible. In fact, to solve the climate problem, we need much more than just an OCA, the carbon insurance company, coming together with the insurance products. We need all the industry to be focused on how do we deliver solutions. So, when I look at the likes of Keter and I look at the likes of what Howden are doing, the announcement last week, it's encouraging for me. It means that, okay, we're bringing more ideas into the space and those ideas will prosper and thrive. And hopefully we can all grow a much more scale market.
No, I agree. I think we sort of I talked on this really lazily, but I did economics and business at university, and I remember they talked about the Italian restaurant principle, and they were saying, "Where's the best place to launch an Italian restaurant?" They were like, "Next to another Italian restaurant," and there was the sort of, if someone's going into the market, you're all raising awareness for each other almost. It's like, especially with a net new product, is to say, "Look, this hasn't existed before," and even if you've got a completely unique product, with the awareness that these are now insurable assets or insurable risks, and you're doing the marketing for you. To a certain extent, speaking of marketing, the Howden thing's made me laugh with the rebrand. Everywhere I go in London, there is adverts for Howden. I'm like, is anyone really using an insurance broker because they've seen it on a tube? I'm not sure, but far be it for me to kind of make comment on the marketing budget of Howden.
Yeah, but let me give you an example that talks exactly to that marketing. From one of the biggest moments in Simply Business's journey was we were out alone online saying that, you know, you could buy commercial insurance. The amount of times I got told that was a bad idea, that it was only going to be distress risks, that you're not going to be picking up the type of business that the market wants, it's going to be too complex, et cetera, et cetera. Direct Line came into the market, Hiscox came into the market, AXA came into the market, three huge brands that started to put marketing dollars behind advertising the fact you could go online and buy business insurance. That actually grew and accelerated our business. So again, as I think about the carbon market, there's us, there's Keita, you know, there's a couple of others that are trying to get into it. We need the big players to be going, we see an opportunity here and we want to put capital in to actually grow it.
Yeah. No, I completely get on board with that sort of competition is good. And also it keeps you honest as well, doesn't it? I mean, that's the thing. Almost the worst thing you can do is have a dominant market position. And we can see how lazy that can make people. Because it's a new market, I just think there's so many sort of parallels from something like cyber. You know, what do we think we can learn from some of the mistakes and challenges that, you know, for example, the evolution of the cyber market has gone through?
Yeah, great question. We get, indeed, in the industry, insurance industry, when we talk about our product and get deeper into how the product is coming into a new space, cyber is usually the comparison. And I have to smirk a little bit because obviously I'd love the start of the cyber market, maybe not the sort of latter part of recent years of the cyber market and its profitability. I think in terms of lessons learned, I think the purchasing of cyber insurance is quite analogous. So if you think about, you know, CTOs back in the day had, you know, did pen testing, had internal security teams, thought they were controlling risk. Cyber insurance was developed and introduced, and it was an emotional purchase in some ways, not necessarily an economic case that was being made. And I think that same case could be made here in the carbon market. There's lots of economic reasons why insurance makes sense, and buyers will think about that, obviously, in terms of the price that they want to pay. But it's also an emotional purchase. If I'm a CFO having to file a 10K and I'm purchasing credits, if they're insured, then maybe I get a reassurance that I've got a recourse if a fire is to happen or an invalidation was to take place. So I think there's some very clear parallels with, you know, how the mindset of an insurance and purchase could be very similar to cyber. And indeed, when we look at the coverages, they're new coverages that we're putting in place. You know, we're drawing from experiences within the insurance market, but they're quite new, and therefore there's a lot of uncertainty. And how do you manage through that uncertainty in terms of the line limits you're putting out, in terms of the deductibles, in terms of the underwriting that you're doing, in terms of which risks you're pricing? What I hope is the lessons from cyber in terms of, well, how do you manage aggregation of losses, and how do you manage some of that cumulative exposures is something that we're focused on quite a lot in our first product, because that is a very serious risk to the market. If we put a product out and a whole methodology gets invalidated, then that's going to be quite painful for us and certainly our reinsurers that we're putting in place. So I think in terms of drawing parallels, it's how do you keep pace and evolve the product to make sure that it's meeting absolutely what the customers want, but you don't get distracted by the fact you still need to make underwriting profits.
Yeah, that was always the thing with cyber. I went to a talk 15 years ago, I think, and we were talking about cyber. And the conversation was saying, if the big internet insurance, if the big internet companies couldn't buy cyber because we couldn't create a product for them, then we'd fail. If we were selling cyber products that basically weren't worth the paper they're written on and didn't really cover anyone for anything, then we'd fail. And we've obviously oscillated towards a product which is usable, but it's like it was a painful evolution of journey. And that's why I was thinking that the lessons to learn from that, and from a talent perspective, you know, I always think about things with a talent hat on. I have to. I run a search firm. That's kind of what I look at. And one thing about the carbon market that I find interesting but also kind of positive from an insurance perspective is that you're seeing much more expertise brought in at the ground level. So you're creating these products with specialists in that field. And that we didn't see from cyber. We've seen it now. Now when people got, they've got cybersecurity consultants on hand, they've brought into the business to help create products. It just took a long time for that to happen, which I found surprising. And the carbon market doesn't look like that. It appears to be the carbon insurance market. I mean, it's already very quickly becoming, these are people that understand this market very, very well, and not just insurance and the insurance aspect of it. I don't know if that's something you've observed, but it seems to be the case.
Agree. I mean, I think, climate tech, carbon insurance, I think it's attracting talent by virtue of the fact that we're trying to solve a big problem that a lot of people care about. So that's good. I think there is a sort of intellectual challenge that I think the carbon market faces that I think for us, we're trying to position ourselves as a pragmatic solution, rather than out-competing each other from a academic standpoint. It's, look, we've got to make steps forward. And I think that's what startups do best, those that succeed, is you take all that information, you bring in all that complexity, you bring all that expertise, but you've got to keep making decisions and moving yourself forward rather than sat there competing as to the academic rigor of the proposition or the technical product that you've got. Insurance from a product standpoint sometimes falls into that, doesn't it? I mean, you get a team of 10 underwriters around a table trying to think about risk. You could be there for a long time trying to get agreement. So you've just got to find a solution, get it out, and just keep moving forward. But to your point, I'm excited because I think we can really bring the talent that exists in the insurance market into solving these problems because people are excited about, bringing their expertise to try and solve it.
Yeah, I completely. There's so much I agree with there, but it was kind of making me smile at that academic piece. And if I'm ever asked to pitch my piece, and it's like, we are a search firm and we run search processes, but we're built for startups and scale ups. And so my very elevator pitch on this, and I don't think I've shamelessly pitched as much on this in 200 plus episodes of my podcast, but I say, if you want a 100-page report, go to one of the blue chip search firms. If you want me to deliver a shortlist of candidates, of which you really want to hire one, then come to me. Because it's about, that's the product we're selling. And the point we're being is, it's like we're pragmatically kind of trying to move forward. Because otherwise you could, for example, if you genuinely want to look for the best talent in the world, you've got to set aside 6 months to find that person and get them on board and lined up. And it's the same as the kind of evolution of your business. At some point, you've got to take a step forward. You've got to have a thesis, and it's got to be smart and thought out, but you've got to move forward with it. And then you've just got to continually evolve that product until it fits the market. Forgive my shameless plug there, Chris. It's not about me. lastly, and I'm really conscious of time, but I could talk to you for hours, Chris. But we talked about sequencing and its importance in the entrepreneur journey. Because you've gone through such an entrepreneurial career, what do we mean by that? And essentially, what does that mean for Ocker over the next 12 months?
Yeah, I mean, it's at the heart, really, of for me, how startups succeed is doing the right things at the right time. And it's very easy to get distracted by what you want to achieve in the future. You need to hold that mission and that vision close, and it needs to guide you, but you need to be making decisions in the short term to give you the opportunity to get to achieve that mission or vision. And that's from simple things like, where do you prioritize effort as a collective, as a team? What resources do you bring in? Do you contract? Do you bring in full time? And being very clinical around, what are the milestones you need to achieve now to get to the next step? And I think many startups fail by virtue of bad sequencing. They make bad decisions in terms of money they want to raise, which products they want to go, the proliferation of products that they want to develop, the team that they want to bring on. I mean, you're always keen, and it's there for me. It's inbuilt human nature, I think, to want to keep growing, building, scaling, but getting focused on what do you need to deliver to get to the next stage. And usually the next stage of the startup's journey is the next round. So what do you need to deliver? What do you need to show in terms of progress? And what do you need to show in terms of playing that game of what venture wants to see to get you to that next stage, to get to that Series A, to that Series B, and giving you the capital. Once you've got that capital, that gives you the opportunity to meet and achieve that mission and vision of a long term. If that's the route you want to take, I've taken a very sort of venture story there. That might not be every startup or every founder's desire, but it is all about sequencing. What do I need today to get to that next stage?
Amazing. That's going to set me off on a tangent thinking about my own business now. But Chris, that's a lovely way to end it. Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure doing these. It's the favorite part of my job. But when you're talking about mission-driven, net new business, that's exactly why we kind of set up the Leadership and Insurance podcast. So thank you so much for being a guest on the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Alex.
Not at all.